Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we are sponsored by the Palm Beach Improv Festival. And Improv U proudly presents the 2016 Palm Beach Improv Festival, September 8th through the 11th at Actors Rep Theater in West Palm Beach. The Palm Beach Improv Festival offers performances and workshops, as well as the chance to build lasting bonds of friendship. Submissions to perform are due by July 5th. Improv U is a nonprofit dedicated to bringing the art of improvisation to South Florida. Register today at palmbeachimprovfestival.com. That's palmbeachimprovfestival.com. We're also sponsored by Chicago Women's Funny Festival, and tickets and festival passes are on sale now, featuring 400 performers, 95 groups, and 83 shows over 4 days, June 16th through the 19th at Stage 773 in Chicago. Browse show listings online by group, genre, or style of comedy to find shows you'll love at ChicagoFunnyWomen'sFestival.com. That's ChicagoFunnyWomen'sFestival.com. Also, if you're in Chicago this summer and you want to study with me, then hurry and sign up for my Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives. These workshops are limited to only 14 people, and they sell out. For more information, go to my slick website at jimmycarain.com. That's jimmycarain.com. And if you like what we're doing here on Improv Nerd, please write us a nice review and subscribe to us on iTunes. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Oh, yes, we've got a great episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Our guest today is Ed Farman. Now, Ed has done 3 main stage shows. I don't know how long I can do this accent for. Ed has done 3 main stage Second City reviews. He also co-wrote Chicago's longest-running musical, Co-Ed Prison Sluts, at the Annoyance Theater. And that's where I got to first work with him way back in the 90s. He is the co-author of the popular show Rod Blagojevich Superstar. He's written for sketch projects at NBC, 2 children's plays, and a best-selling book. We talked to Ed about starting out at the Annoyance Theater and how he developed his unique comedic voice and how he's at the point where he is not worrying about getting the laughs when he improvises. Before we get to that episode, I just want to let you guys know we are about, Lauren and I are 4 weeks away from having our baby, Betsy Jane Crane. That will be our daughter. And I got to tell you this, and I just want to share you, this goes no further than what I'm about to tell you. I'm actually feeling excited about it. I'm not, there's certainly terror, and I'm having a hard time sleeping, but I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I feel like I've done a lot of prep work. We took the baby school, 4 nights of baby school, and it was really boring. We're buying a lot of stuff, which I guess is what you have to do. The other day I went, you have to get the car seat here in Illinois. You've got to get it installed and inspected by the police department. So now I have a baby seat in the back of my car. And I got to say, even though the baby hasn't come, just having the baby seat in the car, I kind of feel like I'm already a dad. So enough about me. I will keep you updated on the birth of our child. 4 weeks, so it could come any time now. Here it is. You're going to love what Ed Furman has to say. Here it is, the Ed Furman episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
All right. Ed Furman, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me, Jimmy.
Now, you grew up in Cicero, Illinois, which is a very blue-collar neighborhood outside of Chicago, and you started doing comedy routines on the playgrounds for quarters. What kind of stuff killed in elementary school?
I did. What kind of stuff killed? I found an old Bill Cosby record to Russell, my brother, whom I slept with. But you know what? That's not really... That's what kind of first opened my eyes to comedy, I guess. It was bits from the Steve Martin albums. The first, like, Let's Get Small and stuff, that killed. And I would, I'd sing Tom Lehrer songs that nobody ever heard of, but I have older siblings. They turned me on to Tom Lehrer. So I'd do bits from that and, Steve Martin albums and those songs.
Now, did that make it, did people go like, hey, Ed, will you do this routine?
Yeah.
And then how did you get the money? How was the exchange of money?
I've been a shrewd businessman my whole life, Jimmy. I don't know. I just like, well, you got a quarter or something? Like, yeah, they give me a quarter and I do something.
And how often did you do this?
Yeah, once or twice a week or something. Uh-huh. I was bored on the playground or if we had to sit in and it was rainy, you know?
Now, were you always a performer, like growing up in your house?
Not really, because I was, you know, my siblings are older, like 10 and 20 years older, so I kind of was an only child, but not, I had siblings, but I was still kind of an only child. So it wasn't a big audience. Mm-hmm. So, but no, on the playground and goofing around in school, I always like to do my own bits.
And then in high school, you did theater and you also played in some garage bands, right?
Right.
Did your brothers turn you on to music?
A little bit. I just found some old albums laying around, but it was like the Bill Cosby one struck me first. There's a Herman's Hermits. It must have been my sister. I kind of like that one, too. But it's just music. I just kind of discovered what my friends. It was, you know, that was like the 70s. They had better music on the radio. Like Led Zeppelin was still producing songs that were on the radio and stuff like that. So it's just, for me, easier to get into music that way.
And then what kind of stuff did your band play?
We ran the gambit from like blues, depending on the band, like blues bands doing blues rock, Cream, stuff like that. Then I got into like the Bad Clams doing punk stuff, which I think Conan used the name Bad Clams something. Yeah. But I think pretty sure we had it first. Bad Clams. We write our own songs. My last band was in Wood with Dave Adler and a couple other people, and I don't read music, and I realize I'm not a musician, so I always have to do a lot of songwriting so I know how to play the songs.
And how did you get interested in improv?
How did I get interested in improv? I'll tell you exactly. I'm old enough. I remember seeing Saturday Night Live, that first season.
Like Belushi, Aykroyd,
yeah.
Gilda Radner, Jim Curtin.
Yeah, all those. Yeah, Garrett Morris, all them. And I was kind of blown away by that and the New York 70 vibe. And then I heard...
What blew you away about that show?
Because I think at first I was really into Monty Python. But that was so different and so, you know, English and foreign. And this was like, these are, you know, people older than me, but this is happening here, like right now in America. And this is fantastic. And I think that's the, like, proximity of, like, hey, this could be a reality. You know, I could do something like that. And then I learned about Second City through, you know, of course, because everyone came through there. And that's how I kind of got into improv.
And you started at where we all started back then, because there wasn't many choices, the Players Workshop of Second City.
Right. Exactly. And Judy Morgan.
I had Judy, too.
She's great, isn't she?
Yes. Really great. And she was also on the main stage at Second City.
With Belushi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you meet Matt Walsh there, right?
Yeah, Matt Walsh was in the same class.
What was Matt Walsh like back then?
Matt Walsh was great. And you always want to have Matt on your team or to perform with Matt because he was very popular. He had a lot of friends, and he always drew a big crowd. But... yeah, Matt was great. We had a lot of fun, and he's just great to collaborate with. In fact, I haven't read the book, but I'm talking to Mick and some other people about, I guess,
Mick Napier.
Yeah, there's UCB text on.
Yeah, called the manual, I think it's.
Yeah, and people were telling me about it, and like, oh wow, that's kind of exactly how Matt Walsh always approached the scene.
And did you do stand up for a while? Or no?
Oh, like everyone had to in the 80s for a couple times.
Right, at the Roxy, right?
At the Roxy, some other place, yeah. You know, just a handful of times. It's a totally different animal.
Stand-up is.
Yeah, yeah. And I just, it's so much nicer for me. Improv is so much nicer to not have anything prepared and just have someone up there with you to do something with. It's just two different lines of thinking. But.
And then from Players Workshop, you end up joining the Annoyance Theater.
Yes.
And how did you end up being in Coed Prison Sluts?
Coed came out of, they were doing Splatter Theater 2. And I auditioned for Splatter Theater 2. I had a bad audition, but under special skills, I wrote that I brutally stabbed and murdered two college coeds in Texas. And that got me in. And it was we performed this show. So it's like, start out with a white stage, just gallons of blood by then. Everything's red. Everyone's soaking in chocolate syrup and
food which was coloring. The blood
that was the blood.
They yeah. would it was red food coloring with chocolate syrup.
Yeah, and I lived right around the corner from the theater, and I had a little small role, but we had to wash up in this sink with no heat in October, and people just quit showing up, and they just give me a call, and eventually I just like hang up and like whatever role needed, like, well, who's not showing up this time? All right, I'll grab a white shirt, I'll do that role, and from that. As Mick asked me, like, hey, I'm going to do something after this. You want to be a part of it? And I said, well, sure. So that turned out to be Code Prison Slice.
The thing that I've always loved about you is your dark sensibility. Where did that develop?
I don't know. I've just always had it. It's just always had a dark, sick sense of humor, stuff that didn't make people laugh.
Were you younger? Did you get in trouble with that?
Sometimes, yeah, in high school and stuff like that, I'd make jokes and then like, hey, come on, that's, yeah.
And then
I just we're trying to come up with ideas for titles for a Christmas show, and one I came up with is spoiler alert: the baby gets nailed to a tree. So if I ever do a holiday show, that's going to be my druthers. That's going to be it.
On that theme, in Code Prison Sluts, which I actually understudied, I was Hamster Man for a long time, you create this character named Slick, who was a pedophile.
It never came out and said it.
Okay.
In my mind, he was always in there for tax evasion, okay. But he just happened to be a really horny guy.
Okay. How do you make a character like that work?
That is a
now great, this is 25 years ago.
This is 25 years ago. Probably couldn't do it today. Yeah.
Why do you think you couldn't do it today?
I just think it's like because, well, for one, I wouldn't, me being 50 now, wouldn't like, no, I have
right,
a little
right,
more
right,
self-censored.
Right, right.
No, this is a real issue, and there's people hurting out there
right.
because of this. Let's not make that joke.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you just have to be. It's to make that likable, you gotta commit. You can't be apologetic in any way. You gotta be, I think, over the top so much that it's like almost protected. You know, like have the dog eating meat off my crotch and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
So it's almost got to be like almost so big and so almost abstract in unbelievable that it makes it even more. It makes it funnier?
Yeah, I guess like dark campy, I mm-hmm. guess would be. But yeah, it's just over the top so it's safe for the audience. So like it's so big that there's a buffer there.
I know a couple times when I did the show, like people would walk out when you did your song and stuff like that. Did you ever personally, did anybody ever try to, after a show, they were offended by it or you got letters or anything like that?
No, it never happened. But actually, you know, when we started, I had to paint my beard on because I couldn't grow a beard. So I had this goatee to make me look older. And I'd take it off and I'd be cleaning, I'd be setting up for the next show and nobody recognized me from the stage because that character's so big. And I just take off the thing and I'm this little, mousy guy picking up trash and nobody thought it was me.
You also said that... about the annoyance, that it helped you find your voice.
Yes.
How did it?
Because of the freedom we got there. Like, you want to do, Mick was great about not censoring anything. Like, we got time slot for it. You got an idea. If you get the show mounted, go up and do it. And just so doing that, and just the sheer volume of shows, when we first got that space on Broadway, we had to have revenue coming in every day of the week. So, all right, we need something Wednesday, late slot.
Right,
what
right.
are we going to come up with? And just having to create really helped me get proficient. And then, just having the opportunity to not having to try to fit in like to something that already had its, voice and established. Like here at Second City, if you're coming in, there's stuff that isn't on brand with Second City. That joke kind of wouldn't really work here, but the annoyance was like just kind of finding itself and didn't have any of those restrictions early on, so you could do anything.
What was one of your favorite memories about the annoyance?
Favorite memories? I just liked, like, you never knew what was going to happen or the weird things that would come through. You know, there's just the great people in shows. I love doing Brain Warp.
What would you like about it?
Brain Warp was Brain Warp the Babe Eater. It was a late midnight show. Eric Hoffman had this character. Brain Warp just kind of drove one of those guys. And he'd just do the stupidest jokes and the biggest, gags. And it was just so much fun. I like the freedom and the silliness of it.
Well, the other thing that was always interesting about you is, like, you love to do puns sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And just do the almost Catskills kind of stuff. And it always seemed to work with you. What was your secret?
I don't know. I think it's just that I loved it so much, you know? I just think of that, and that that follows the audience career. I was having so much fun. I think that's kind of the key, that the audience is on board with you. You know, if you're trying to get through a show or just remember your lines, like, the audience is there. But if you're just, you know, I'd always laugh on stage and stuff, but I was just having so much fun.
But I think what's interesting is you did break on stage a fair amount of time.
Yeah.
But also, I never saw somebody more focused in a performance.
Oh.
You know, and so, yeah. Like, I remember watching Your Butt, and just you were so focused and so in the moment. How did you develop that skill?
I guess I just must have learned it going through in high school, theater stuff in high school. Tom Rusnak, my teacher, told me acting is reacting. So you just focus and stay on the moment. And react to what's going on. I guess in improv classes too. You know, I think one of the things I think Judy did is help us work on our acting chops too. So and also from improvising, you have to focus on the other person. You know, or else you're gonna miss something. You're gonna be out there treading water. So it's just like that's just the commitment and focus you need.
And the other thing is, you always brought joy to what you did. How did you develop that? Whatever character you did, there was joy. Even Slick, you know, there was joy
sure.
to it.
Oh, well, what's the point if there's not, you know, if there's not joy? You got to be doing it for, you know, nobody's getting rich doing that stuff. You better be having a good time, or else I could be out at the bar.
We talked about your comedy being edgy at times, and it seems like today a lot of people don't want to be edgy. Why do you think it's important to be edgy in comedy?
First of all, I could see why people don't want to be edgy. It just with so much social media out there now, and everyone can anonymously comment on what you're doing. I think, you know, first of all, if you don't want to be edgy, that's fine. If you don't have an edge, don't put it. But if you have an edge, I think it's just I think it's important to be true to yourself. And I just happen to be kind of a dark person. So that's where the edge comes in. That's what makes me laugh. That's where my brain goes. You know, a lot of people get in comedy are kind of twisted, dark people.
Yeah, right.
And it's a good defense mechanism for us. And you just hone that defense mechanism into some semblance of a career.
Right. But the thing is, sometimes that defense mechanism gets in the way of your real life.
Sure.
Have you experienced that?
Sure.
Like somebody will say something and you're just like, okay, I'm just going to joke it off. Even though I may be hurt about that or angry about that.
Are you saying like you've ever made a dark joke I regretted or something?
No. Have you ever made a dark joke that you regretted? Or you've gone too far in a social situation?
Probably. I remember my mom used to work at a factory and one of the girls got hurt. Under her, like, she's a foreman, and I just saw a Michael Donahue bit about a bunny who got his ears caught in a machine, and I told her that, and it didn't cheer her up at all. She just looked at me like, why would you tell me that horrible story? I remember that one, and I don't know, I probably have. I know I'm sure I beat myself up at some point for everything. I don't like hurt anybody.
Right.
I don't go into comedy to be mean or make people cry, and when people, like, are mean that way.
Right.
I don't enjoy that kind of comedy.
So also my original question is, do you think in a lot of ways, because I know for me, comedy doesn't let people in. Mm-hmm. Do you think you've done that with comedy? I know I have.
I don't think... Oh, you're putting up more of a veneer?
Yeah, like, you know, I'm going to joke about something, but inside I'm dying and have a lot of pain.
Oh, no, I haven't gone... I haven't gone like that.
Okay,
I know. And I don't think it's keeping people out, because there's not a lot of people knocking at the door to get in.
Right.
Not me, you know? My wife loves me, or my family loves me.
Right. But I remember the annoyance people would... Didn't you win some award, like... Most Eddie is an enigma or something like that.
Yeah. So, yeah. But that was, I don't know if that was all comedy. That's just me in general or something.
Now, after the annoyance, Mick asked you to be on the Second City main stage.
Yes.
And you didn't even have to audition, right?
I auditioned to get into the touring company.
So you were in the touring company?
So I was in the touring company. I quit the touring company, and then I got on the main stage.
And then you said, at the annoyance, you found your voice, but at Second City, you refined your voice. Can you explain?
Yeah. I found out getting too weird in the sets for Second City.
The improv sets after the shows.
Weird, you know, I lobster claw nipple guy ain't gonna work.
And how did you come to that conclusion? Did someone pull you aside, or did you just figure it out for yourself?
Oh, the crowds let you know, Jimmy. The crowds let you know. And I think Dorf probably gave me a
Kevin Dorf.
Kevin Dorf probably took me aside and gave me a, yeah, you know, that.
Was that hard for you? Because here you were at the annoyance, a superstar. You know, everything you did was great and well received, and now you come to the main stage and it's like, oh, fuck.
There's a little bit, you know. I mean, Dorf and Steph weren't too happy to see
Stephanie
me.
Stephanie Ware,
who's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, she's amazing.
Yeah. Both of them, two of the best improvisers.
But you got a little resistance when you first came.
Yeah, because, you know, everyone thinks it should. I was an outsider, and there's so many great people already in the touring companies, and people have gone in as understudies, and like, who's this Pollock they're bringing up on the stage?
Well, essentially, you jumped your place in line, technically, right?
Technically, yes.
I mean, the way Second City looks at it, like a post office.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think I'm lucky. I know it's just Mick fighting for me. Luckily, Mick and I get along great, and we always do great work together.
So how was that, like, okay, I'm the outsider. How did you eventually fit in?
You fit in, well, you know, you get so tight in a rehearsal process with your cast. You're there, you know, what, 6 hours a day, mm-hmm. every day, and then doing shows at night, that you develop that camaraderie, and you just do so many bits during the day. You kind of learn your place, you learn your voice, you learn where you fit in. That way, it's just the sheer hours.
Did you ever feel like quitting at a point, or just
when I quit?
No, but I mean during that process, like, oh, they're not accepting me.
Oh no, this was like, you know, this is what I came to left Cicero to Chicago to do. It just took me 13 years. And a whole other theater thing to come in and do it. But again, on the main stage was great. I remember one of the times I felt like I'm making air quotes, made it.
Right.
I was back in the hallway. I was in Ruby's office.
Ruby Street, our
musical director. And I was walking past the bathrooms, and it's carpet. I walked past the woman's room, and my foot squished on the carpet. Like, oh, there's something wrong. And I realized in a split second, like, I don't have to clean this up between acts. Someone else is going to take care of it. I just have to go up there and do a show. I'm not going to be out there with a shop vac.
And explain that a little, because at the annoyance, what we had to do.
Oh, geez. Especially on Clark Street, when we get rained, our basements would flood real bad. And you'd go and sing your song, and while the show's going on, then you have to shop vac the basement, run and dump out the water and come back on for your next entrance. And everyone is a bucket brigade. Everyone's running out and someone's on the roof trying to unclog the gutter.
Well, I remember on Broadway, Kahlua, the late, great Kahlua, who was the dog in Coed Prison Sluts. I hope I'm not bringing up any, you know, sadness, because we do all miss her.
Sure.
She, in her later life, would just shit on the just anywhere.
Yes.
And so after a while, I think people got tired of cleaning it up, and we just walked around it.
Yes. Yes, there was just a pile of, there's just a big puddle of urine in the hall. Yes, in the lobby.
I want to share something with you because when I interviewed Mick a while back, this is a story doing COVID prisons that, and I just want to know if you remember this. It was one night we were doing COVID prison sluts, and you and Joe Bill were backstage, and you, I believe you had a bottle of Jack Daniel, and you were passing it back and forth.
It was probably what were we drinking? It was probably Southern Comfort.
But Southern Comfort, you're right. And it was a big bottle, as I remember. And you killed the bottle, and of course, when you got that kind of drunk, the show would kind of, you know, it was like in a time warp.
It breathed a bit.
Yes. So that night, Mick is walking through and seeing the last clown when the clown dies at the end, which is a big group number. And the next night, we get this note. And I don't know if you remember this, but I remember this specifically. Mick said, from now on, no more hard liquor during the show. Beer is okay, but no hard liquor. Do you remember that at all?
I think I remember that, yes. Yeah, I remember that. That's when we had to start hiding our liquor in the hole in the wall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, after that was 8 years into the run or something?
Yes.
6 years
I don't know how you did it. Because after a while, I did it for like a year and a half, Friday and Saturdays at 10:30. I was like, I can't do it anymore. But you did it for like 8 years.
Like 10.
10 years. How did you keep it fresh?
When
you weren't drinking,
it just there a lot of people were walking in and out, so you never knew who you were performing. Night it was a different cast, so that helped. And it just, I don't know, you just got. I'm a creature of habit, so 10:30 on Saturdays, I knew where I was.
On the main stage, what was one of your favorite scenes that you did? You did three reviews here.
Yeah. One very fun one was from the first show, a scene called Midnight, and it was Rich Tellerico, Kevin Dorff, and myself. We were three divorced guys who were getting the band together, and we'd get, Richie played guitar, Kevin was on a snare drum, and I played bass, and we'd get suggestions from the audience, we'd just make up three songs, and that was a lot of fun. One of the funnest scenes I've been in. I will say there's some scenes, because I'm here a lot in the
Second City.
Second City. And I was looking at some archive scenes for some reason, cataloging something. And there's a scene from one of the shows I was in. It. I had no recollection of ever seeing it before. And I know I must have done it at least 300 times. And I'm like, no, new to me. No idea how this ends. No recollection of doing this at all.
How do you think you blacked that one out?
I don't know. It was more than just that scene. There's a few of them. It just, it goes through you. You know, you don't dwell on it. And it just kind of goes through you. I rarely remember any improv scenes I've ever done. You just be in the moment and it goes through you. And I don't know. I don't remember those scenes.
You seem like someone who's, when they're done doing an improv scene, you don't analyze it, you just let it go. What do you do when you're done? For instance, like a show you do with Dan Bacadol, which is great, Trainwreck.
Mm-hmm.
When you're done with that show, is it just gone, or do you talk to Dan about it, or?
We might, we don't analyze it. We might say what hit, or if you know, it might make kind of like, oh, you're just kind of swinging for the fences early there, you know, or something like that. But we don't analyze, oh, what are we going to do next time? Because, you know, we went 10 years without doing
right,
it. So,
right.
Lord, and Dan's, you know, Dan Stock, I don't know how much longer his people are going to let him, you know, do this improv show.
Right.
So, no, we don't analyze that.
But were you always like that, that you didn't go for a lot of notes in your head or relive shows when you were done?
Well, early on in the, you know, early on, I was in a troupe with Matt Walsh and Andy Dick was in it for a while, called the Department of Works, I think. We do shows, and then we'd analyze a lot of stuff. But that was, we liked doing that. But no, after, like outside of classes, and in classes, I'd analyze stuff a lot. But after that, once you're performing, I mean, just unless you're in a real slump or something like that, I just let it go through.
Later, so how do you decide to quit? You did three reviews. That has to be a tough decision to decide to quit Second City, something that, like you said, you know, took you 13 years to get.
Well, see, that last process, my last show was set to open September 12th, 2001. And we were real topical up then, Embryos on Ice. We were cutting edge. And that was a process. We had a director who ended up getting fired, who was horrible, in my opinion.
What made him so bad?
We don't have to say his name.
Okay.
I mean, a clown.
Mm-hmm.
That was his background.
Okay.
And that shit don't work.
Right.
That wasn't working with us.
Now, how do you, because, again, the annoyance, the thing that I found special about the annoyance is you could anoint anybody a director, and we would follow it. Mm-hmm. We would follow them. And that was such a great gift. How does someone like Ed Furman deal with a clown as a director?
I was getting a paycheck. That was my job. I come from working in a window factory. You just do your job and, you know, roll up your sleeves, and that's what was my job to do it.
Does that make you appreciate everything you've gotten coming from the window factory?
Sure. I think that's how I treat my material. You know, seeing, like, you know, I don't hold on to anything precious. It's like, you know, if it's a scene I really love, like, this isn't right for the show, all right, chuck it out, I'll make another window. You know, put that one in there.
But what about when people complain and they're like, oh, we don't get this, and, well, you know, how we do, I know, yeah. I do. Do you just think in the back of the mind, well, I came from a window factory.
I roll my eyes a little bit, so that's over mind. You know, we've been on tour, or Bisco gigs especially, I'd be like, guys, we're staying at the Ritz-Carlton, and we're going to do a two-hour show for a good amount of money. Well, let's keep things in perspective.
So 9/11 hits. The show isn't topical.
Yeah.
And fill me in how you make the decision to leave.
Well, they got to go. Yeah, this is one of those. It was a little nebulous. Like, the higher ups here at the time, like, all right, we got to go right in rehearsals, right back in. Like, this is just that show is everybody's either first or last show. And then, I think, who was it? I think Josh Funk was directing it, and, like, he might have suggested, hey, maybe you ever think about quitting or something? Something like that might have happened. Or, like, maybe, like, I might not be in the show, something like that.
Because the director says who's in the cast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pretty much. Director and, mm-hmm, and the producer at the time. So I'm like, you know, I'll say my goodbyes now.
Were you happy with that decision?
I was okay with it. I wasn't real happy, but I wasn't ready to go back into a process, mm-hmm, so long after the world just changed, and that last process was so onerous.
Was there anything left on the table that you would have liked to done in a review?
I couldn't say what, but yeah, I was.
You weren't done.
I could have had another. Yeah, I could have had another show on me. I think I'm writing sketch comedies. Like, that's what I do. You know, that's what I'm best at. I don't want to write screenplays or, you know, even, you know, pilots or writing anything long like that. It's just a lot for me. But I like to short hit sketches, and that's my art form.
And then after you left Maine, you started writing shows for Second City, where you would go into other cities like Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Dallas, right, and you would write customized shows for that city. How did you immerse yourself in that culture of another city to be able to write about it?
That was kind of all handled for me and whoever I was writing with. I did a lot with T.J. Shanoff and some other folks. But they would, the theater we were working with would set up, we'd have, like, you know, 14-hour days where we just go different parts of the city, meet different people, eat different things, see different things, and try to learn about as much about the culture as we could. Some visits were more successful than others. You know, after I'd done a few, I'm like, I'm not talking to the alderman. It's going to be a waste of time. You're going to get sound bites, and he's not going to say anything real. Let's go talk to the people who are having coffee over there while we're getting some food. They look like natives.
What is the best way to find out about the culture for comedy when you go to a different city?
What I would always do is ask the same questions to different people. What's the biggest source of pride that you're average person in Cleveland has? What are people in Cleveland proud of?
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, they ask it to someone else, and they say, you know,
the Indians.
Yeah, Yeah, and just...
And so what would you do with that information? Somebody says the Browns. Somebody says, you know, Louis' Rib House.
Well, I'd listen for repeats. What I've got some multiple hits that really raises the flag. Like, all right, we have to hit that. We have to be true to that. And otherwise, and if it's something that I hadn't heard of or it was something that wasn't like that was surprising, I'd do more research about that and then ask other people about whatever that was.
And then you did a show called Rod Blagojevich Superstar. You also did a show,
Leonard Skynyrd.
Yeah, right. The Power of Prom.
Yes.
What's the one?
Rush Limbaugh.
And you did those with T.J. Shanoff.
Yes.
And they were all musicals.
Yes.
What is your process when you create a show together with T.J.?
Well, I hope to be going through that process again pretty soon, but TJ's going to be a dad soon, and mm-hmm. I'm just moving. But TJ and I work great together. We find an idea that makes us laugh. Actually, Second City came to us with Rod Blagojevich, and like, mm-hmm. well, sure, why not? This seems like a no-brainer.
Well, he was going through all the trouble. And
it was right at the heart of it, right at the perfect time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so just like then we go and like, all right, what's the story? Where do the songs fit in? And then usually I go write the book. And
when you mean the book?
Well, I write the dialogue, the words. And he goes in and he writes the songs and mm-hmm. we generally put it together. And TJ and I work well together because we really listen to each other and respect each other. And we don't, often the other one will have an idea that we don't like.
And how do you settle those?
We say like, all right, you have to sell me on this idea. I don't like it. You have to sell me on it. Mm-hmm. And then whoever has the idea does a pitch and either flies or no or doesn't.
Now, does he leave the dialogue in the book part alone? And do you leave the songs that he creates alone? Or do you say, hey, I think it'd be better here? And then he says something to you?
More of the latter. But like 70%, we just have like kind of, I'd say roughly like 70% of the mm-hmm. time we leave each other alone in that area. But mm-hmm. we each have input in the final show, so we want to be happy with everything across the board.
Mm-hmm. And then in 2004, you got married.
Yes.
Okay. And after you moved to Milwaukee, and you told me 10 years you were in Milwaukee. Were you afraid that you wouldn't be able to continue doing comedy when you moved there? Because Milwaukee, it's known for beer, it's known for cheese, but not for comedy.
Yeah, I tried to get just a regular job there, and turns out I'm unfit for everything.
What happened? What did you try to apply for?
I applied. I lived right around theater, right around the corner from like a cool art house movie theater. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that'd be a cool place to work. I'll check out all these movies. And I, you know, you give me a real form, like, who's your last boss? So I haven't had, I don't know, who, Kelly Leonard maybe? I don't know. Like, and I was making, you know, like, how much do you make? Like, well, you know, the corporate comedy pays real well. Yeah. So I'm like, well, all right, this ain't movie theater money, I know, but all right, but just, and I didn't even get a call back from them. Yeah, and like, all right, and this isn't, I think I've gone too far into the water to turn back and have any other kind of job.
But was there a part of you like, oh my God, here I am in Chicago, I've had tons of opportunities, I'm going to Milwaukee, and that's it, it's over.
Yeah, I felt like that, yeah. But it was, I kind of retired. Like, thankfully, I didn't lose my, thanks to Rod Blagojevich and stuff, I didn't lose my home or anything. My wife was doing well out there. And I really love Milwaukee. I had a great time there. It's just, and it's interesting to kind of, well, introduce people who had never heard of Second City. So you have to be, I'm just Ed Furman to these guys. You know, how do I fit in? And you realize you're away from your tribe, even among actors and stuff, some really great people, talented people. But, you know, you tell a joke and just goes over everyone's head. They're not looking for the bits, I guess.
And you said you tried to get something going in improv and you brought Joe Bill out there.
Yeah, Joe Bill and I do a show, a two-man show from time to time called Jed. And I brought him out there to do it. And I think like, hey, come on out, we'll do the show. And you could teach a seminar and we'll make a little money. And I think six people came to the show, and then like four people came to take his class. So I was like, oy, that hurts.
And then last month, your wife, you decided to move back to Chicago.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do that?
I started working full-time here at Second City.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been commuting here since October.
And you were doing, like, freelance writing for them?
I was doing freelance. Yeah, I was working from home the whole time I was in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice. I had, you know, the dog and take walks by the lake every day. And I was really like I got to retire when I was 40 and just work for 3 or 4 hours writing, which some retired people might do for fun.
Right.
But, yeah, and so then I got the full-time job here, which is great, because turning 50, I'm like, I can't be waiting for the phone to ring. You know, what else? I
got was that what you were doing in Milwaukee? You would just wait for the phone to ring, and Second City would say, hey, would you write this show, or we've got
Second
this business?
Second City or something, yeah. Or, Mick called me up for you. Mick would give me a gig from time to time where I'd go writing out in L.A. And
what'd you write out in L.A.?
I wrote a very prestigious show called Untitled Sketch Comedy Project.
Okay. Was that the one Mick was involved in?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of Chicago people.
There's, yeah.
Like Blaine Swen and Chris Redd.
Yeah. Alex Moffat. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was that experience?
It was great. It was funny because Mick and Lou Wallach. Lou didn't know me then, but
Lou
Wallach.
Okay. Who was he on the project?
He was producer. He's okay. Vice President of Comedy Central.
Okay.
So they got me on, but they got me on as a local hire. So I had to fly myself out there and put myself up. So I stayed at Super 8, like in a kind of a shitty part of West Hollywood, and took the Red Line to Universal every day.
You took the public transportation.
Yeah.
Were you a performer or a writer on that?
I was just a writer.
Okay.
But, you know, it was a great group, and you just, you know, all day, all right, write more sketches. You know, Mick's great. He'll like, all right, we got 2 hours. Everyone write 5 blackouts. So like, oh, okay. You know, in the time you got, you just pump some stuff out. But it was great. I thought I'd hate L.A., but I don't. I had a good time. I saw a lot more people I knew than Milwaukee in L.A. I'd bump into people at the grocery store and stuff. But yeah, I could, LA is a great place to work. I wouldn't want to be looking for work there.
Mm-hmm.
I see why a lot of people don't.
Was there any inkling like, well, you know what? I've done pretty well on this project. Maybe I'll see if there's other opportunities in LA.
I thought about it. I was trying to get like my wife Leslie to go visit there because people said she'd get work easier than I would.
Cause she's also an actor.
Management.
Yeah. Oh, she's in stage management.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that just didn't work out. It's a little far from, you know, her family and what's my family's kind of sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to stay in the Midwest as long as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's no one was begging me to go out there. I didn't have representation. I didn't have any heat on me. So there wasn't a lot of incentive to go out there.
Now, I've always thought you are an incredible performer.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But for the last 10 years, you've made your living as a writer.
Yeah.
Now that you're back in Chicago, do you want to do more performing?
Not really.
Really?
Not really.
I mean, Ed, you are a great, great performer. You have no interest at all.
I'm not firmly against it, but, you know, I'm not writing a show for myself or anything. If something comes along, you know, I'd like to do... you know, if season will have me, I'll do Messing With a Friend here and there. But I don't, you know, I'm not going to go out and have like my Thursday show or something. That just doesn't appeal to me at this point.
Do you feel that, because I always think like, okay, it's about expressing yourself. I think as improvisers, performers, actors or whatever, it's really important we express ourselves, that part of us. Do you feel with the writing that you're getting the same thing you got out is writing as you do with performing?
Yeah. The only thing that's missing is the applause, you know? And especially writing, because some of the stuff I wrote to pay the bills in Wisconsin, it was like, oh, we need a scene about compliance for the oil industry. Oh, sure, okay. I'll learn about the oil industry and make jokes about compliance issues. All right, and that was oddly satisfying to me. It's like finding, you know, oh, it's a comedy. It's a comedy puzzle. There's comedy hidden somewhere in this docket of stuff I'm supposed to learn. All right, I'll find the comedy in there and pull it out. It was kind of fun. And
is weird. That how you look at things? Like, it's a comedy puzzle. There's comedy in there.
Yeah, that's how I look
at
it.
Are you a crossword puzzle guy or a chess player like Dorf was? Or
no, No, it's just the comedy thing, finding the joke in there. You know, one of the things we do every day, we like read the news and write jokes for Twitter or do our live newscast from the writer's room. And it's just, that's fun for me. I call it comedy Sudoku. You know, find the hook.
And you're in a thing called the writer's room, right?
Yes.
And how many people are down there at one time?
We've got, it's kind of, you know, we'll have like 7 people tops mm-hmm. in there. Yeah.
And do assignments come down and you all work on it together, or how does that work?
Yeah, we're kind of finding our voice in there on that. Writing the big fun thing we're writing on now is a show for the Kennedy Center in Washington. That's in rehearsals. And we have a lot of original material for that. And what we've been doing is people write a script and we've then been just reading it with the room. And people giving in their input, like a TV writer's room. Mm-hmm. A joke here, you know, this would work better if this, mm-hmm. if the stakes are higher in this. Mm-hmm. And that's turned out to work real well. We got some really strong material out of it working that way.
Now, you're a journeyman. You've been around for a long time. I imagine some of the writers are younger.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's younger than me. Yeah, yes, come on.
How do you bring the generations together in terms of comedy? So they're coming from a slightly different point of view than you are. Your comedy's a little darker.
Yeah.
How does that work?
It works fine. I don't know how it works, but I think maybe because I've always been such an outsider anyway that this is not different being the old white guy in the room. You know, I'm kind of just comfortable in my skin as the old white guy. So that works, and everyone's very respectful of each other, and it's a really good creative environment to work in.
Now, you classify yourself as an outsider. How were you an outsider growing up?
I've never been really comfortable in social situations, I guess. And again, maybe growing up as being mostly around older people because, like my closest sibling's 10 years older, so her friends, you know, I just hang around older people. And I guess it comes from there. And like I said, I got a dark, weird sense of humor. And I wasn't big into sports growing up, so not a lot to talk about. So you just go in your own mind.
And you also said that you were a stoner that turned into a preppy.
Yes, in high school.
Can you explain that?
I'd hang out, I went to Catholic school first year. Then I went to public school, which is great. I found theater and stuff in there. And I'd be the long-haired guy hanging out in the smoking lounge because you could smoke in high school.
Right.
Back then, yeah. Back in the 80s. And then my friend Dan Klobnick and I, one year, decided to start dressing nice. We had jobs, and we just we started wearing ties to public school and stuff just to be dicks, I guess.
That outsider perspective, how has that helped you with comedy?
Looking outside in at something just gives you a better perspective of what's really going on, or maybe the underlying truths that people might not see, or what's really being said, like through a headline, what the really meaning or meanings behind actions.
Does it make you more of an observer?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I try to be pretty... Either I'm staring off and not paying attention to what the hell's going on, as my wife will attest to.
I get that all the time. You're not listening to me.
Yeah. What the hell are you doing?
I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
Do you ever? Sometimes my wife will catch me talking to myself, in my head. Do you ever talk to yourself in your head?
Yeah, I try not to do it around other people.
Okay, I do it all the time.
And when I was working from home, all the pets had voices, and I talked to all the pets all the time.
What do you mean? Give me an example.
And a side with cat and a monkey. You're not funny, Polak. Get away from that computer.
No, you keep saying, you keep using the word Polak. Is there some shame about being Polish?
Oh, no. No. It's that's what I am, term of endearment. Yeah.
But Furman is not a Polish name.
I guess if the R is pronounced as a D, then it's more Polish. Mm-hmm. And maybe like footman, like someone, a horse.
Right.
A horse.
And Cicero was pretty Polish. I mean, it was working class, right? Italian, Irish, Polish?
Italian, Polish, yeah, Irish, Mexican.
Did people make fun of you? I mean, a lot of Polish jokes when you were growing up?
No, I was the one telling them. Yeah, I was like, Polish jokes But no, everyone was pretty something or another, so it's just an ethnic neighborhood. So.
You're also known for just doing great characters, but when you play Trainwreck with Dan Bacadal, the roles seem to reverse in terms of you play more of a straight man to Dan's characters.
I do, yeah.
How is that for you?
That was weird and wild, because usually I like going for the joke. First, I like doing, I like doing the real-time stuff. I heard about when I first did Bass Pro, like, you're just doing one scene. I love this.
Mm-hmm. What do you love about just doing one scene in real time?
You don't have, it's the egg, what do you call them? Edits.
The tag-ins and the tag-outs. Like,
who got it? It's exhausting.
Right.
Exhausting. Dude. Right. I ain't got that energy level.
Right.
So
Trainwreck is long scene.
One long scene, yeah.
In real time.
One long scene, real time. And, yeah, Dan's, when we started doing it for a while, Dan would get a hot hand early on. And I like,
what do you mean a hot hand early on?
He gets some big laughs early on. He'd take, when you do one long scene, you can't go for the joke too quick. You go for a dumb joke and it falls and you gotta sit in that for for another 25 minutes.
Right. So you don't have you haven't built a relationship or a storyline to.
Yeah.
To help you out.
Yeah, but a few times Dan start get a big laugh up top, so I'm like, all right, I'll feed him and I'll like let him run and be the straight man in that.
What did you learn from that? Because again, everything you've done is so character based.
I think you just you really learn to commit at a different level and be in the character and constantly always be like scanning what's going on, where is this going, whose status is higher, how can we flip the statuses to have closure for the piece, what's the end game going to be.
Are you using a different part of your brain?
Yeah, I think you're using two parts of your brain at the same time, kind of going back and forth.
And you seem like someone who likes a challenge, who's not worried like, okay, I'm not getting the laughs as much as I did before. But I don't care because I like a challenge and I'm learning. Is that a fair assessment of
you? Yeah. In fact, we do, Joe and I, Jed, we know each other real well. We're more likely to fuck with each other and, have a good time that way. When Dan and I do Trainwreck, I go on, it's all business. And last couple times, or a few times, I'm like, I'm not going to try to get any laughs. I just want to see if we can keep the audience held and keep their attention for a half hour, 45 minutes.
How are you so generous? Because people listening to this podcast are going to go, oh my God, I can't, people tell you don't go for laughs. How have you been able to be that generous on stage and not care that you're not getting the laughs?
I think it's, I think it's like some people get sober and like, I don't need the booze.
Right.
Well, 10 years in Milwaukee writing, not getting any laughs, like, I don't need the laughs anymore. I can function fine without them. Boy, they were great when I was getting them. I don't need the laughs anymore.
So that was like a spiritual awakening for you up in Milwaukee?
I get, yeah. It was like a sweat lodge. It was a slow burning.
Do you remember when you realized, like, did you get up in the morning or did you do a show or later on when you came back to Chicago and go, you know what? I don't know. It's just, it's left. I don't really need the laughs.
I remember at some point, writing like, what I thought was really good, like, oh, that'll get a good laugh. And instead of saying like, oh, I'm just like, well, I'm all right, I'm getting paid, let them get the laughter. That's fine. I'll just send you the
check. That was something that up until that point you hadn't felt?
That's something I hadn't realized that occurred, as a writer.
And how has that changed you as a performer and as a writer?
I don't perform anymore is how it changed. I don't feel the need to perform.
But when you
anymore.
Do perform?
I guess like what you said, generous. If like, I'm in for the scene. Yeah, I think more like a writer now. So like, I want to provide layers. I want to provide some structure I don't have to worry about. I'm not out there looking for the laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out there looking for the scene.
Mm-hmm. I'm still, when I perform, it's like I want the laugh and stuff like mm-hmm. that. Is that just an insecurity, do you think?
No, it's an honest want. That's what, you're a comedian. You're mm-hmm. out there doing a comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the audience wants to do, generally go out there and laugh. So that's, mm-hmm. no, there's nothing wrong with going out there and wanting to get the laugh. That's how I came up.
We've got to wrap this up. This has been great. And we always end the podcast with asking the guest a piece of advice they'd give to someone for starting out in improv today.
It's maybe a cliche advice, but it's one I think is really important and true. And it's play the game in the scene and play the scene in the game.
Can you explain that?
Yes.
The first part and the second part.
Play the game in the scene. If you're on there, don't just be two people talking about something. Find some sort of playfulness in there. Whether it's, there's like exercise, like try to get somebody to touch something without them knowing it. Something like that.
It could be something that simple.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. More often it's like, and when you're in a game, like if you're in the alphabet game, don't just think about the letters. Have something real going on. Or if there's a, if you're doing a conducted story, give somebody the eye. Or if somebody's making a bad joke, show the human interaction. And not just the words. Mm-hmm. That's gives it an extra layer.
Okay, Ed Furman, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you, Jimmy, for having me.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I loved when Ed was talking about if you heard me in my voice, I'm almost like, how do I do this? The whole thing about not worrying about getting laughs. I hope that I get to that point sometimes because I am. Sometimes I'm there, but most of the time I'm counting laughs in my head. I want to thank our guest, Ed Furman, and I also want to thank the Second City Training Center in Chicago and Jesse Swanson for providing us a place to conduct the interview. I'd like to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes it sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, The Artist Low Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media, like our Improv Nerd Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and go to our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and see clips from our live show. We're also part of this wonderful podcast collective called FeralAudio.com. Check out all the hilarious and innovative podcasts at FeralAudio.com. I want to thank both our sponsors today, the Palm Beach Improv Festival and the Chicago Women's Funny Festival. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk. Don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.